You're listening to episode 167 of The Secular Buddhist. Welcome to The Secular Buddhist. I'm Ted Meissner. The Secular Buddhist is the official podcast of the Secular Buddhist Association, a grassroots-driven effort to answer the needs of secular teaching and practice for contemporary society. The podcast has interviews and roundtable discussions pertaining to engaged Buddhist training and practice, and the SBA website has show notes for each episode along with resource materials. Though the podcast focuses on core practice from a secular viewpoint, more traditional teachings are welcome and openly discussed. Bhikkhu Sujato joins us to speak about the ordination of women in the Theravada tradition and his work with canonical veracity in the Authenticity Project. How do we know for sure what Gotama said? We probably can't, and we can further muddy the waters with unsupportable assertions about the perfection of the Pali Canon as the true word of the Buddha, or we can use the fine minds we have, apply some reason, and have some engaging conjecture about consistent messages showing through the various texts that have come to us through the ages. Of course, there are going to be differences of opinion and valid acceptance of criteria. That's expected. We're not measuring the rate of a falling object in a vacuum and can't expect that kind of accuracy. That doesn't mean we can't ask the questions, and it doesn't mean we can't be enthusiastic participants in companionable dialogue. Ajahn Sujato is an Australian Buddhist monk. In 1994, he left his music career to take a higher ordination in Thailand in the forest lineage of Ajahn Chah. As well as living for several years in the forest monasteries and remote hermitages in Thailand, he spent 3 years at Bodhinyana Monastery as secretary to Ajahn Brahm, and also over a year in a cave in Malaysia. So sit back, relax, and have a nice Twinings Australian afternoon tea. And our guest today is Bhikkhu Sujato. Bhikkhu, thank you very much for being here.
It's great to be here, Ted, and thank you for inviting me.
It's a great honor to meet you. I have enjoyed your book, History of Mindfulness, that, as I mentioned before we started, I picked up several years ago at Bhavana Society in West Virginia, and it's just a wonderful work. So I'm very happy to meet you. And, of course, your blog, sujato.wordpress.com. Is a wonderful example of how to engage with others in a friendly fashion, even when you may disagree about things. And I am very appreciative of your example in that.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah.
So why don't we get started by having you tell us a bit about your background and how you as a Westerner encountered Buddhism and how that led to having a monastic life.
My background, born in Perth, Western Australia, grew up as went to a Catholic school, believed in God for a while, and then I didn't. I was became an atheist when I was about 15. I started reading about the theory of relativity and things like that, and the world that science showed me was so much bigger and more interesting than the world which I saw in the Bible. So I stopped believing in God. So for many years, that was my orientation. I was a straight-out atheist. I guess I still am an atheist, depending on how you define it. I became a musician. I went to university, studied philosophy, dropped out after a while, Became a musician. I played in a band called Martha's Vineyard. You can look for us on YouTube if you like.
I will link that to people listening. What did you play?
I played guitar and I wrote songs. Yeah. And occasionally vocalized. Some people would hesitate to call it singing, but anyway, I made noises into a microphone of a vaguely melodic sort. So I did that for a while, and that ended up being impermanent for some strange reason. So artistic differences and yada, 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 we broke up. I did various other things and ended up having a bit of an existential crisis. And as a result of that existential crisis, I ended up going to Thailand, more or less just to, I don't know, remove myself from my life and to try something else. Looking back, yes, I would say it was a spiritual search, but at the time I didn't think of it that way. I suppose you don't really, you know, phrase it in those terms.
Not with a worldview as an atheist at the time. That would have been very challenging for you.
Yeah, very challenging, yeah. I mean, somehow I had always had a the few occasions when I met people who were Buddhists, you know, I always had somehow a kind of positive response. I always had a kind of respect or a regard for that, which was quite different from, you know, how I felt about Christianity. But anyway, ended up in Thailand. And as you do when you're in Thailand, you're staying in the guest house and, you know, you sort of realize that the monastery is a bit cheaper to stay at because you can give a donation and, you know, no one's going to check if you don't give much of a donation, so that's good. So I thought, oh, well, I'll go and stay there and do a retreat for a while and see what this meditation business is all about.
Had you done a retreat before or any meditation before that point?
No, nothing.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, so this was really you know, in the deep end, and it was seriously in the deep end. My first retreat was at a monastery in Chiang Mai called Wat Rampung, which is it's a kind of modified Mahasi Vipassana technique. And they do, the first retreat they do is like a 26-day retreat. It's pretty hardcore. It's like 14 hours a day of meditation. And then they get you to do like 3 or 4 days at the end where you don't sleep.
Mm-hmm.
You just keep on meditating around the clock.
That would be meditation boot camp. Yeah, that's the deep end. You're right.
So that was my introduction to meditation, you know. And it was fantastic. You know, there's obviously lots of dukkha and stuff, but I had a great time. Obviously, I'd hesitate to recommend it these days to, you know, I mean, obviously a lot of people didn't come out of it so well. But I had a fantastic experience. And at the end of that, I just knew that, well, this is what I wanted to do. Somehow it had opened up a vision of the mind and of consciousness, which it never even occurred to me to reflect on or investigate in that way. It was just completely revolutionary for me. So I just wanted to keep doing that for the rest of my life. Yeah.
So how soon after that did you then take the vows of home leaving and become a monastic?
Well, it took a while. Yeah, I mean, after some time, I ended up with, you know, I was staying in Chiang Mai and I was playing music in the different nightclubs and stuff in Chiang Mai, and then I'd go and study Abhidhamma in the monastery in the daytime and stuff. And one time, I was sitting around with some friends and they lit up a joint and they were passing a joint around the table, and then it came to me and I kind of looked at it and then I just passed it along.
I've done that. I know that circumstance. Yeah, that's feeling a bit odd man out at that point.
Yeah. And they, you know, my friend just kind of looked at me and said, "You should become a monk."
You're halfway there already. You're not smoking a joint. Might as well become a monk.
So, yeah, well, that was the first time anybody told me I should become a monk, so it was something to it. So anyway, I travelled around Thailand. I did a few things. I stayed for a while in Mae Hong Son in this little, I don't know how to describe it. It's a kind of it's a sort of spiritual organic farm for refugee kids. who were kind of orphaned from the war and so on in Burma. And they keep them on this property and teach them how to do farming and harmlessness and some basic Dhamma and give them an education and stuff. So I stayed there for a while. And that was great. And I just travelled around and did a few things like that. And one of the stops on my journey was at this monastery called Wat Manachat in northeast Thailand, the International Forest Monastery, which was established by Ajahn Chah in the 70s. And so I came and stayed there for a while, and just really loved getting into the practice, and I loved the spirit of authenticity. That's something which has always been important for me. Even when I was a musician, I never liked kind of glossy pop music and all of this kind of stuff. I liked kind of dirty raw blues music or something like that. It was just something in me has always kind of longed for this kind of sense of something genuine and something authentic. And when I saw that forest tradition, then for the first time, I mean, when I had experienced the meditation retreat in Chiang Mai, the meditation was great, but you could see there was a lot of stuff about the lifestyle and so on, what's happening in the monastery, which is not particularly thrilling and particularly inspiring. But when I went to the forest monastery, and it was like, oh, this is really, what the Buddha was talking about. This is really kind of doing the, doing the thing, and you can see how holistic it was, how integrated it is, and it was, I just really loved it. So stayed there for a while, and after a few weeks, the monks went on a retreat in Ganchanaburi, and it's on the Burmese border, not far from where the Death Railway went through, on the River Kwai. But we were staying in very, very deep jungle there at a place called Dardam. And we used to do the... I was still a layman then, and so I went along to do the cooking. So I get up in the morning and go down and do the cooking and so on, and it was just a fantastic time in the real pristine jungle. So that was where I decided to become a monk, and so that's what I did.
Excellent. So how long were you there, and what led to your current location and your role there?
That's 20 years ago, so I don't know how much I'm into. Look, I was in Thailand for about 5 or 6 years all up, and I also stayed for 3 years in Bodhinyana Monastery with Ajahn Brahm. That was also something that I really loved, and I felt very much at home. In terms of a community in a monastery, Bodhinyana is always been a place where, I just felt so accepted, and so it's just a very warm and very lovely community, which is, that's a special gift which Ajahn Brahm has, to make everybody feel so welcome and so appreciated. So I just stayed there. I ended up about 10 years ago, I went back to Thailand after I was in Bodhinyana. I went to Malaysia for a while, I went to Thailand for another year and a half, and ended up coming back to Australia, and I more or less stopped by this property in Bundanoon to see what was going on there and so on. There was one monk at the time. And anyway, I ended up staying there and becoming the abbot and running that as a forest monastery for 10 years. So Santa Forest Monastery. And last year I retired and made the place into a bhikkhuni monastery. So now there's a bunch of bhikkhunis up there.
Wonderful. Let's talk about that for a few minutes. That's a good segue to one of the things we wanted to chat about a little bit here.
Yep.
Ask about your thoughts on the challenges faced by the Bhikkhuni Sangha, just getting ordained and what some of those problems might be rooted in.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, problems facing the Bhikkhuni Sangha, my goodness, where do we start? I mean, of course the root problem and the basic problem is that in Buddhism you have we have a number of different Buddhist traditions, right? And of course, you know, it goes without saying that each one of those Buddhist traditions has many things of value within that, and people find inspiration and so on within those Buddhist traditions. So that's not a question. But I think it's probably fair enough to say that for most of us from, let's say, a non-traditional Buddhist background, the specific advantage of Theravada Buddhism is, especially if you're interested in a monastic life, is that it does have a much more kind of grounded and authentic approach to monastic life compared to the other traditions. And so, you know, typically you find that that there's, relatively speaking, you know, more interest in monastic life in the Theravadan community. There's a lot of Westerners who are ordained in the Tibetan tradition as well, and I know obviously they find a lot of nourishment from that. But the lifestyle is not as well supported, it's not as well maintained, and there's not the same sense of acceptance, I think, not the same sense of kind of acceptance and solidity in the Sangha, in the Tibetan circles, as you find within the Theravadan circles. So I think in terms of finding a really supportive and suitable monastic environment, currently, the Theravada tradition is the best. But, of course, the big problem is, well, that's fine for us blokes, but for the Sheilas, it's not so easy. Sheilas, by the way, is an Australian word for women. And it also happens to be the Sanskrit word for virtue, so it's kind of okay.
It's a nice one to use, yeah.
So for the ladies, of course, very hard, because in the Theravada tradition they don't have the bhikkhuni ordination. Now, so what are we to do about that? Well, some women just are happy to, you know, go into the monastery and practice and be a preceptor or wear white and be a mechi or something like that, and they just stay there and get along with their practice, and that's fine for them. But there's a bigger thing. Sangha is bigger than just individual practice. And especially the monastic sangha, there's a sense of connection, there's a sense of interrelationship, there's a sense of history, there's a sense of time. All of those things which go into making it something which is actually very powerful. And we don't see in, mostly in the Theravadan countries, you know, we don't see the same strength in the women's communities that we see, for example, in Taiwanese Buddhism or in Korean Buddhism, where the women play a very, very strong role. They run universities and they, you know, run international charities and they do all kinds of things, which you just don't see in the Theravadan tradition. So we have this problem. So if they want to live in the forest and be supported to meditate and live an authentic monastic life, then Theravada is pretty much the only option at the currently in the West, and yet there's not the option offered for women. So when I saw this, and this is something which has been growing in me for a long time, and it's not, I guess not just a recent thing. I mentioned before that I was a musician. When I was in Muso, we actually, when we did our first national tour of Australia, we had to have two roadies go on the tour with us. That was one of the requirements in the contract. And we had two women who were our roadies, right? And this is absolutely unheard of in the music business. You see, women can lift black boxes, you know.
See, it isn't so.
This is craziness. So, we ran into some serious kind of obstacles with that. So maybe there's something, you know, it's probably been going on before I was a monk anyway. So, yeah, so, and I've seen, since I've been a monk and everywhere you go, there's always more women than men wanting to practice. And many of them very serious, very dedicated, and would really love to have that opportunity to practice in a monastic environment. So where is it and what can we do? So I just started to look around, and I heard, for years, I heard all of the arguments that the Theravadan monks would give about the lineage is broken, the tradition will never accept it, you'll cause a schism and go and roast in at each ye hell, and so on. And after careful consideration over many years, I realized that I didn't believe any of that stuff. And I thought that actually the real obstacle to bhikkhuni ordination was power, misogyny, narcissism, irrational fear, and a whole bunch of other stuff, which I was kind of disappointed to discover within my tradition, the tradition which I loved so much. But what can you say? No one's perfect.
Yep.
So after years of trying and failing to start a dialogue and to interest people and to talk about it and to study and to educate and so on, I mean, when I say failing, I mean, it was a success to some degree, but not in many quarters. So anyway, then eventually Ajahn Brahm decided that he wanted to go ahead, together with Ajahn Wayama, they decided that they were going to go ahead and do the bhikkhuni ordination. They told me about it, and it was terrific. So we supported, we organized it, and we went to the famous bhikkhuni ordinations in Perth. When was it, 2008?
I think it was 2008, yeah.
October 2008. And, of course, that sparked this firestorm of controversy, which was completely unexpected by any of us. I mean, we thought, yeah, well, a few monks will grumble about it, and then, you know, we'll have a nice chat and a cup of tea, and then they'll, like,
no. Everything will be fine.
Grumble for a while, and then they'll just kind of sit back. Usually what happens is that people will grumble, and then they'll sit back, and after a year or two, you get kind of used to it, and then it's not an issue. So we kind of thought that something like that would happen, but we really didn't anticipate the strength and the virulence of the response. So anyway, so we did what we did. And so anyway, so now we're facing we have to have the bhikkhunis ordained. And since then, of course, there's been many other bhikkhuni ordinations, and there's been, you know, none of the same kerfuffle as there was. The obstacles that the bhikkhunis face, of course, you know, when you have that sort of contradiction, on the one hand, that the love of the tradition, the love of the practice, and the recognition of the authenticity of that way of practicing, especially in the forest tradition, and yet at the same time, these irrational and inexplicable fears of women and so on, of course, that's a terrible thing to, you know, to emotionally bear for women. I think the thing that's really surprising to me is, you know, why there's anyone at all who's going to persevere in the face of that. But fortunately, there are, and so to me, that's the single major thing. In addition to that, of course, there are other issues in terms of getting support and so on, but the second issue, which I think is a major one, which is not, I think, anybody's fault, but is just the way it is that because the Theravada Bhikkhuni Sangha is very young, then there's not the same kind of depth of elders and experienced teachers and practitioners and so on as in the Bhikkhu Sangha. So that's something which I know that, you know, many of the nuns have expressed to me that they feel the lack of that. They feel the lack of having, you know, so many elders and so on they can relate to. There's very few places, you know. If you're a monk, if you don't like one place, you can always leave and go somewhere else. Much harder to do that for the bhikkhunis. So this just happens to be how it is at the moment. And, you know, that will change over time. It won't take too long. We'll see the bhikkhunis will mature, get more experience. And, you know, there's already many places opening up. I mean, in Australia, of course, we have two full-time bhikkhuni monasteries now at Santi Forest Monastery and Dhammasara in Perth. They also have a little vihara in Melbourne at Sangha Mitarama, and they're looking to establish a full-size forest monastery there as well. So, and of course, in America, you have Aranya Bodhi and a few other places as well. So there are some places now, certainly much better than it was a few years ago, and I'm sure that will continue.
Yeah, and I expect that it will, that this fundamental shift in the gender makeup of the Theravada monastic community will continue to grow despite a lot of the challenges that you've mentioned. I think there's an excitement on the part of, I think, more progressive-minded folks that we're setting aside these issues that really don't have to do with the teaching and practice, that they're non-contributive to how well someone can teach or right. do meditation or the rest of it. And for many of us, it just seems such an alien concept that this would still be something we see, and yet that is a part of human society, that we do see a variety of different attitudes, some of which are, I think, culturally based. And over time, things will change. And it's good to see, honestly, some of the best teachers that I've had have been bhikkhunis, and they're extremely dedicated because they need to be to take those steps, not just with the challenges you face, but the rules for the monastics, for the bhikkhus, is usually rated at around 227, give or take. But the ones for the bhikkhunis is, I think, well over 300, as I recall.
Yeah, 311. Yeah.
Yeah. So they've got a lot, they've got quite a. They need to be very dedicated. We'll put it that way.
That's true. I have to add as a footnote, as a Vinaya scholar, the difference between the number of rules is much more of an illusion than it appears. I don't know if you want to go into the technicalities of it, but I mean there are a few differences of substance. If you look at the differences of substance, there's no kind of generalization that the bhikkhuni's rules are tougher than the bhikkhu's rules or vice versa. Actually, there are different cases.
Well, let's take a turn over to the topic. Another topic that we want to focus on for this conversation is the Authenticity Project that you recently announced on your blog. Yep. Tell us about what that is and who your partner is in that.
Okay, so authenticity, it's kind of ironic you mentioned that, I'm talking about Buddhist, I'm a monk talking about Buddhist authenticity on my blog. I don't know. I've seen something a bit wrong there. But anyway, so this is a project that I'm doing with my very good friend, Ajahn Brahmali. And Brahmali's a Norwegian monk. And I've known him since I first went to Bodhinyana all those years ago. Very lovely monk and very well studied and very intelligent. And we had some chats and so on. We were there. And one of the things that we talked about and one of the things we kind of whinged about together was the current state, or what we perceive to be the current state of dialogue around how we relate to the Buddhist scriptures, and particularly whether we think the early Buddhist scriptures are authentic, whether they're actually spoken by the Buddha, whether we can recover in a meaningful sense the Buddha's message, and so on. And both of us felt that the dialogue around that was uninformed and unhelpful, and ended up wasting a lot of time talking about non-issues, basically because we feel that many people who talk about it, including, I should say, many of the academics who make statements about it, not just on blogs and so on, are just uninformed and don't know the facts. So we conceived this idea, the Authenticity Project, to basically assemble the different arguments for the authenticity of the Buddhist text. Actually, what we did when we started it, we wanted to do something which would be neutral, and we'd say, well, these are the arguments for and these are the arguments against. But when we were kind of doing that, we found it quite difficult to say the arguments against the authenticity and keep a straight face.
Yeah, the arguments against evolution are, that's going to be tough.
And we kept on saying kind of variations of, but this is uncertain, and it got a bit tedious after a while. So we thought, well, look, we'll just give the arguments for authenticity. But one of the things that we would like to do when we publish it is to invite and encourage somebody who's skeptical to present a similar thing from the point of view of skepticism, so people can see the different points of view and make up their own mind. So our main point with this project is we're not trying to tell people what's authentic and what isn't or anything like that. What we're trying to do is to say, well, here are the facts. These are the historical facts. This is what we know. These are arguments which have been brought forth. We're combing through as many old texts on Indology, history of India and Buddhism as we can get our hands on, finding arguments which, see, many of these things were stated, in the 19th century, or they're stated in some obscure journal, or they're bits and pieces here and there, and we're trying to pull all of those out. You know, for example, I'll just give you some examples of some of the things that we bring in. For example, not many people are aware that there's a Greek indica, a book on India, which was written certainly less than a decade after the Buddha died. So this is something that's a very kind of unusual fact. So when we read, for example, in the suttas, there's one reference to the Yonas, to the Greeks in the suttas. And so some people have said, well, this shows that this must be a late insertion because the encounter between the Greeks and the Indians only happened, 100 years or 200 years later. So this must have been inserted. Well, in fact, that's not the case. Herodotus refers to Indians in the army of Darius, and there's the indica was written a few years after the Buddha, and so on and so forth. So we know that there was some knowledge and some cultural interchange even from the time of the Buddha. So that's one argument. And we go through literally dozens of little historical points. We try as much as we can for this project, at least at the time being, we're trying to be as empirical as we can, and we're focusing on things that are simple and specific and concrete. We're staying away from the theory. We have some theoretical arguments, but we're sort of trying to soft pedal that. Later on, maybe we might do some journal articles or something where we develop the theory of it in more detail. But at the moment, we want to assemble things like the geographical knowledge, the political situation, the social situation, the language, and these kinds of specific details, and pin them down as much as we can. I don't know. I could keep on talking about this for quite some time. I don't know whether you want me to keep on raving about the Authenticity Project.
I do it. Yeah, let's talk some more. I like that one example that you had was terrific, because I think you're right. Most people are not aware of those historical elements that contribute to the overall story. And you've done much more study than even many scholars have in this area. Are there a couple of other examples of things that are common misunderstandings that you keep tripping over that might be things people would be interested in hearing, just to the additional information that they weren't aware of before?
Okay, let's take another specific case. Let's look at politics. In the Buddhist scriptures, the political situation is fairly clear and extremely consistent. We have a number of different countries through the region where the Buddha lived. Kosala, with its capital Savatthi, Magadha, with its capital of Rajagaha, the Vajin Republic, with its capital of Vaisali, and so on and so forth. And in a few places, it refers to the 16 nations which were in the region. And that's a quite consistent picture, and it's one which is not just mentioned in one or two isolated places, but which is embedded in countless references and dialogues and settings and so on. So you have the whole of the early Buddhist scriptures. And I should just sidebar here. I should have mentioned what we're talking about here is the early Buddhist scriptures, which is essentially the common components between the Pali Nikayas and the Chinese and other Agama texts. As well as part of the Vinaya, although we really only consider the Patimokkha and maybe a few other parts of the Vinaya to be really early. Certainly the Vinaya is a bit later than the most of the suttas. So that's what we're considering as the early Buddhist scriptures, and our basic thesis is that those early Buddhist scriptures are in fact spoken by the Buddha, or at the very least are a product of that early time, the early generation. So we want to make a strong claim so that, you know, we've got something to argue about. There's no point in being wussy about it. So anyway, come back to the politics. So we have this political situation, and that's very well described, quite well understood, and it's really not possible to envisage the whole context of the Buddha's teachings outside of that political situation. Yeah, there's so many discussions with the kings of the time, King Pasenadi and so on, or, you know, and it's just inherent in the whole milieu at the time. Now, according to the most recent scholarship on the dates of the Buddha likely passed away about 400 or 410 BCE. This is what we call the Median chronology. And I won't go into that in too much detail, but there's been many different dates proposed for the life of the Buddha, and this date we call the Median chronology has been recently, in the last couple of decades, has been accepted pretty much by the main scholars in the field. So we're following the Median chronology. So the Buddha died about 400 BC, maybe a little earlier. Now, about 80 years after that, Chandragupta came to power. And Chandragupta was the emperor of a massive empire covering almost all of India, up to Afghanistan and down to the south of India. The total area that he governed would have been comparable to that of the modern Indian state. The whole political scene was completely different to what's depicted in the early Buddhist texts. Chandragupta's capital was the city of Pataliputra. In Pataliputra at the time was a Greek ambassador called Megasthenes. And Megasthenes wrote quite a lengthy account of his stay in India, which is preserved, reports of that is preserved in a number of Greek writers. And Megasthenes gave quite a detailed description of the city of Pataliputra. That detailed description has been confirmed by the archaeological digs in Pataliputra, which is modern-day Patna, the size of Pataliputra, its construction, and so on. And so here, 80 years after the Buddha, we have a completely different social scene, completely different political scene. And what's very interesting is that in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, shortly before the Buddha passed away, the Buddha actually crossed the Ganges River, or is reported to have crossed the Ganges River, at the little village called Pataligama. And Pataligama was probably just a little fishing hamlet at the time. But the king of Magadha, King Adadasattu, was building a fort there because he wanted to attack the Vajjayans across the ocean. Now, of course, this was the beginning of that kind of expansionist effort from the Magadhan Empire, which ultimately resulted in the great empire of Chandragupta and later King Ashoka. So Pataligama went from being an almost unnoticed little fishing village to being the greatest city in all of India in 80 years. So this is one of those facts which is so embedded in the context of the suttas that you don't really notice it. It's not something you see in just one place or another place. But if you ask the question, how is it possible that people writing at a later date would have invented that earlier scene? If people were composing the texts after King Ashoka, why would they have invented a political scene from 200 years before? How would they have known about it? How would they have described it? We have many examples of Buddhist scriptures where people write the suttas and so on. I'm thinking of, say, Mahayana sutras and other things which are written at a later day. And they've backdated them to an earlier time, right? And they're very bad at getting the history right. when they do that, when they are ahistorical texts, it's very obvious. You know, it's very easy to see this is not sort of, you know, meant to be seriously taken as a historical document. You know, whereas in the suttas, you know, these details are always correct. The political scene is always there. The geography is always there. And the idea that somebody writing hundreds of years later could have invented that is simply ridiculous. Frankly, it's just absurd. Now, that doesn't prove anything, really. It doesn't prove that the Buddha spoke those texts, okay? But it would seem rather curious if the Buddhist tradition had got all of those political and geographical and social details right, but had got the teachings completely wrong. So they got the unimportant stuff, what for them was unimportant, they got all that accurate, but all what they thought was the essence, the important thing, what they're actually trying to preserve, they got that completely wrong. So I find that, you know, just a ludicrous idea, and one which, you know, as soon as you bring it to light, you realize how untenable it is. Of course, you know, if they've preserved these accounts, the historical accounts, then the purpose of those historical accounts was to give a setting for the teachings, and that was what was wanting to be preserved. That was the important thing. So this is one of the main lines of argument that we're developing. There are many others, but you can see the kind of the tendency here, and the tendency in the kind of argument that we're bringing is not, it's not kind of a proof. We can't prove that it's authentic, but you can say, well, the theory that it's authentic is the most simple and natural and straightforward explanation for that state of affairs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go with Occam's razor.
Occam's razor, exactly. Yeah. And this is something which I believe the skeptics really don't take seriously. I mean, they propose that the texts were all composed later and so on, and they've never taken that seriously and really actually proposed how it's possible to invent these later texts with stratified hierarchies of doctrinal development and linguistic development and so on, and how it's possible and why that would be invented at some later date. Nobody's ever taken that question seriously. So what you find with the skeptics is they throw these ideas out. Oh, we can't be certain. We don't know.
Though that may be true, that's not a reason to set aside valid conjecture about what things may have been. That's interesting, and that doesn't hurt anything for us to do.
Oh, exactly, yeah. No.
One thing I did want to ask you about, as you were mentioning the external verification through other sources outside of the tradition, we have often heard of this as being an explanation for the validity of the person of the Buddha, that we have confirmation from Jain texts that they refer to each other as contemporaries. Could you tell us a little bit more about that? Because that's about as far as, that's certainly as far as my knowledge goes, and maybe for some other listeners as well.
Okay, the Buddha was part of a complex and varied religious scene. Now, there were two, commonly described as being two sort of great wings of the spiritual scene at the time, is the Brahmins and the Shramanas. Brahmins, of course, being the followers of the Vedic tradition and the ancestors of what we know today of as Hinduism. The Shramanas being the rebels. They rejected the Vedic tradition, they rejected the Brahmanical authority, they rejected the caste system, and they claimed to have access to truth through experience and through their own investigations and inquiry. Of the Shramana movements, of which there were very many, the two which were ultimately most successful were the Buddhism, obviously, and Jainism. And Jainism, of course, still being a living religion in India. The Jainism is older than Buddhism, and the founder, or more likely reformer of Jainism, who was an elder contemporary of the Buddha, is known in the Buddhist text as Nigantanataputta, and in the Jaina text as Mahavira. Both the Jain texts and the Buddhist texts acknowledge that they're contemporary. They both set these texts in approximately the same time, and they both have recognizably the same social and political and so on conditions in which they're set. And they're both, we want to focus on the social and political things because they're more concrete. But, I mean, actually, ultimately, of course, much more important is the philosophy and the practices and so on. But we tend to be a bit nervous about focusing on that because it's much more open to interpretation. But clearly, you know, there's a grappling with the same kinds of questions, approaching the same problems in sometimes similar and sometimes different ways, which to me places the Jain texts and to some degree also the early Upanishads, the Brahmanical Upanishads, in the same sort of cultural sphere.
Yeah, it's interesting that as you bring up the concrete facts of a political situation, that as that is, as you're describing, less important than, say, the ideological stances that ones would be more passionate about. If we think of this in contemporary context, we don't really question that, you know, in our various political systems, we have in the United States a two-party system, and we vote for president, and there's all this striving going on with that. That's simply part of our environmental background, so we don't even really think to edit that. So what we describe in that in something of an offhanded way would have been the same situation 2,500 years ago, that this is simply part of the background noise. There's no reason to craft it in a different way. And as you're bringing up the example of this one small village, which very soon would become a major capital of an empire, think of it as describing Rome as just a little hamlet 20 years ago. We know there would be no reason to do that, except that that may have been the situation at the time that they were writing. There's no reason to do so. So there's some interesting validity to what you're saying, and I'm eager to see how the project progresses. And as this gets published, I know you were, as on your blog and the way you engage with others, inviting that discourse with other scholars who may have a different view and seeing that progress. I'm very excited over time to see what comes out of that and the things that we can learn just from having the dialogue itself.
Oh, absolutely. And this is, you know, this of course is what we hope. I mean, obviously you don't hope to persuade everybody, you probably don't have to persuade anybody actually, but at least to have a more informed dialogue. And I think that's something which has been lacking. If I mentioned before that we're trying to be theory light in this, we don't want to get too kind of heady about it. But of course, we can't sort of completely resist that tendency. And what's become clear to me, and what I think has been the major theoretical, I guess, clarification or development for me, is to look at what kind of thing is this argument for authenticity? And when we're going through, we're looking at individual pieces of evidence, and we're trying to infer the most simple or straightforward conclusion from that. And it seems to me that what we're doing and what the history of that search for authenticity has been doing is essentially similar to a scientific theory. It's like falsifiable. And you know, for example, like the theory of authenticity was first developed, say, in the 19th century by the German and English Indologists, Rhys Davies, Oldenburg, and so on. Now, since that time, the theory is very, very highly exposed to falsification. If you had a single, for example, Ashokan inscription, you know, there are dozens of Ashokan inscriptions covering, you know, thousands of lines of text, and if there was a single mention, for example, of a Mahayana sutra in any Ashokan edict or in any inscription from that period, then all our ideas about early Buddhism would have to be thrown out the window, and we'd have to go back to the beginning. So it's very highly exposed to falsifiability. It's also very fecund as a theory. It's allowed us to develop an understanding of ancient Indian geography, of the languages, the relationships between the different languages, the Gandhari, the Prakrits, and so on. It's allowed us to trace the doctrinal development, the influence of Buddhism on Hinduism, and so on and so forth. It's allowed us to integrate the Greek and the Indian texts and histories of the time, and so on and so forth. And that's just in terms of the worldly knowledge that theory of authenticity has enabled, leaving aside the fact that that theory of authenticity has also been a driving force in the reformation and revitalization of Buddhism, not only in the West, but also in traditional Buddhist countries for the last century. And this is what we call Buddhist modernism, which is a fascinating topic, is to look at the way that these ideas have played out in so many different varied ways. I mean, let's just take an obvious example. Every time you see a Chinese monk or nun these days, or from Taiwan, you'll see them, they'll be wearing brown robes, which are similar to the color that I'm wearing. Well, that's a modern reform in Taiwanese Buddhism, where they adopted the color from the Theravadan countries under the belief that it's more authentic because of this advent of Buddhist modernism. So that's just one little example. But there's so many examples where this theory has actually led to meaningful results in all kinds of ways. And when I compare this to the theory that the early Buddhist texts are not authentic, then it seems to me that it lacks all of those characteristics of a scientific theory. I don't think it's particularly falsifiable. I don't think that it's likely, or perhaps not even possible, to come up with evidence that would satisfy somebody who is very critical about the authenticity of Buddhist scriptures. I mean, even if you came up with, massive inscriptions in stone of Buddhist texts dating from 500 BC, then certain scholars who should probably remain nameless would say, well, we don't know that the Buddha himself wrote that. I mean, the Buddha, he didn't even probably know how to write. And who do we know who his secretary was, and what kinds of interpolations did they put in the texts, and so on and so forth. So you can keep asking these questions. Similarly with the idea of fecundity, which is a major component of scientific theories. And then you ask, well, what's the outcome of this theory of skepticism? What has it actually produced? And as far as I can see, it's produced pretty much nothing, either theoretically in terms of understanding of Indian history or anything else. The only thing I think which it's produced is it's discouraged a generation of students from actually studying the Buddhist texts. And this is, I think, quite a sad thing. And when I was thinking about this, I was thinking, well, if the theory of, the Buddhist texts are not authentic, if it's not a scientific theory, then what kind of thing is it? And this is probably the most controversial claim that we're going to make, is that it's actually a form of denialism, that it shouldn't be compared with a scientific theory. It should be compared with creationism or climate change denialism and these kinds of things.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, that's exactly the point that I wanted to get to as someone who is a part of a skeptic community. And we had this discussion in our social circle just this past weekend, is what where the lines of distinction are that I, as someone who's a scientific materialist on science issues, would have a level of need for repeatable, demonstrable, unambiguous evidence that would probably be a bit higher than we could even conceivably apply in areas like what we're studying here, and that there's often a misapprehension of skepticism as being a closed-mindedness. It's not. It's to help us try to discern what is more accurate from what is less accurate. Yeah. And that often goes far into a realm which I agree with you. I would consider denialism, where you do have valid evidence that is clear. And bearing in mind, we're going to never know for sure, of course.
Yep.
But that we can have the dialogue that will lead to areas of inquiry and growing and increased community building and practice. Yep. These are beneficial discussions for us to have, even if we don't all get to a point of agreeing on the same point. And I'm completely with you. The concept of denialism is often mistaken for a healthful skeptical attitude about things.
That's right, yeah. And, you know, and of course, I agree completely. Skepticism is good, you know, criticism is good. You know, we certainly don't want to, blindly accept everything. And, you know, neither Venerable Brahmali or myself, you know, believe that everything in the Pali canon was spoken by the Buddha. I mean, clearly it wasn't. But, you know, we think that there's a way of meaningfully finding out what was spoken, what's important and what's not.
Yeah. I've also found philosophical deconstructionism to sometimes be as unhelpful, that there is a certain degree of benefit from picking things apart and looking at them. Where I'm a bit challenged sometimes by that is that we pick things apart and then we leave them broken on the floor, and there's
exactly.
No reassembling, and there's no progress that's made out of it. It just ends at the broken toy in the ground, and that's
exactly.
It. There's nothing further.
And you feel very clever about yourself because you've managed to pick apart some 2,500-year-old ancient scripture and shown that there's a contradiction in it. You know, it's like, well, congratulations. You know,
yeah. That's so what? And it seems to be a thread of intellectual one-upsmanship and cleverness that's great. I'm glad you're feeling better, but how has that helped society move forward? Are you really helping things, or is, you know, what's the background of this? How is that changing things in a meaningful, positive way? So something else I wanted to ask about briefly is some of the difficulties faced by translators and what they run into. That there are, as you mentioned, the suttas may not be literal works that are consistent across all versions. What are just some of the key elements that you found with those challenges?
We have a large amount of texts. This is, of course, one of the problems with the study of the area. It's so big. A large amount of texts. The two main collections of early Buddhist texts are in Pali, which is the ancient Indian language, which is close to the dialect that the Buddha spoke, or one of the dialects that the Buddha spoke. And in addition to that, we have a very large body of translations, ancient translations of similar texts into Chinese. Those translations were mostly made around 400 AD, some of them made a bit earlier, or quite a bit earlier. And in addition to those Chinese texts, we have some in Sanskrit, most of which hasn't been published yet, and also some bits and pieces in Tibetan, only parts of which have been studied, mostly in Peter Skilling's excellent volumes on the Mahasutras. So now the comparative study of this body of literature is very much an underdeveloped field, and there's only a tiny handful of scholars, actually not even a handful, a sort of half empty hand of scholars who are working on it at the moment. By far the most prolific, of course, Venerable Analeo, whose output is astonishing and intimidating in terms of both its quantity and quality. And he's done such an amazing work to bring to light these studies. Prior to Venerable Analeo's work, most of the study that's been done in that field has been done by the Japanese scholars and some Taiwanese scholars. And most of that material is not translated into English, so even a lot of the academics and so on are not really aware of what's been happening in those circles. So we have these texts, that we translate them into English. Now, the Pali texts have been translated, the important Pali texts have been translated a number of times into English, sometimes well, sometimes not so well. And of course, in any translation, The translator has to make all kinds of subjective judgments about what words mean in particular contexts and so on. And that's particularly the case when you're dealing with texts which are very removed from us in time, which are in a very alien culture, which are dealing largely with abstract and spiritual things. And of course, it's much harder to translate abstract terms than it is to translate concrete terms. So there are many problems with the translation. However, having said that, the problems with the translation are not as great as you might think, largely because of the excellent language sciences developed by the ancient Indians. And from the time of Patanjali, who lived within the century after the Buddha, we have the most amazing, sophisticated grammars and descriptions of the language. We have extensive commentaries on all of the texts and so on. So for most times, actually, we're quite capable of making pretty accurate translations. Of course, when we compare and what we have in these different collections, we should be clear about this. We don't just have a body of teachings in Pali and another body of teachings in Chinese, which are kind of similar. Okay, what we have is literally thousands of texts which are virtually identical. And when we compare the Pali and the Chinese texts, we notice if you do that for hundreds of texts, you notice consistently through hundreds of texts that there's almost never any significant difference in the actual teachings. There are frequently differences in incidental details like the setting or the sequence or structure and so on. So these small details might change, but the actual teachings, with very, very few exceptions, I honestly think that the major exception really is the Satipatthana Suttas when I did the history of mindfulness. I think that's probably the most doctrinally significant of all the variations between the Pali and other texts. But in terms of the rest of them, across not just once or twice, but thousands of suttas, they're the same. And this, of course, is one of the major arguments for the authenticity of the scriptures. Again, these textual streams were separated from the time of King Ashoka, so from the time maybe 150, 200 years after the Buddha. One group of the textual reciters was in Kashmir, okay, so in modern-day Pakistan and Afghanistan. Another group was in Sri Lanka, okay, and that's a long way apart. And they walked, right? You didn't just Skype backwards and forwards and say, I've forgotten the ending to this sutta. Could you remind me of it? And I mean, once you've gone there, then that's pretty much it. And so these, as it happens, almost all of the early Buddhist texts that we have are from one or other of these locations. There's very few from the center of India. Almost everything is from either Sri Lanka or from basically Afghanistan and modern-day Pakistan. And they have, those textual streams have been separated for something like 2,200 years and have still retained, quite obviously, that great fidelity. So again, this is one of the arguments that we make, is that it's just unreasonable to suppose that the tradition was capable of passing them down so accurately for 2,200 years, and yet for the 100 or 200 years before that, was unable to pass them down accurately and ended up just making all of this stuff up. That we find to be a completely unscientific and irrational kind of supposition. Yeah, so when it comes to translation, usually what we find is that obviously working from the Pali texts is best. The Pali texts are very clean, very well edited, and the language is very well understood. So it's much easier translating from the Pali than it is from the Chinese. And we can also be much more specific because the language is much closer to that of the Buddha. Whereas when we're dealing with the Chinese translations, well, there's always a bit more vagueness. When it comes down to that close level of analysis of particular words and their meanings, then there's much more fuzziness in the Chinese translations. But if we step back from it a little bit and look, you know, not so much at the word level, but at the sentence level or the paragraph level, then that fuzziness disappears, you know, and we can see the paragraph clearly has the same meaning as the paragraph in the Pali, even if we might not be so clear about a couple of the words there.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. And you make those points in your book, A History of Mindfulness, and I will be linking that on the episode page for this episode. And I thought I'd also put out Analio's book on Satipatthana as well, because that is another brilliant scholarly work. It's one of my favorites on foundations of mindfulness. I also wanted to chat just very briefly about an upcoming thing. This will be a surprise and delight to many of our more geek-minded listeners. Let's talk about Cylons and artificial intelligence. That's probably not a topic you expected us to be talking about with the Venerable here, but let's chat about that for a moment. You have an upcoming work that you're involved in.
Yeah. Well, I've been doing, over the last few years, I've been trying to do from time to time kind of dialogues with the people from different backgrounds, you know, maybe philosophers or psychologists or people from different faiths and so on. So I thought we'd kind of pretty much exhausted the human realm, so I thought we might as well go into kind of having a discussion with a cyborg and then see what out of that.
Tell us more. What's happening?
Well, look, details. I probably shouldn't mention any details because everything is still too much up in the air and I wouldn't want to implicate anybody without
guilt by association.
But one of my close friends who's been helping me a lot in Sydney is he's a robotics engineer in his spare time when he's not managing my Dhamma Talks website. And we've kind of talked about these kinds of things. Now, what I've noticed is that there's this sort of nexus between Buddhism and neuroscience, right? Which is quite well known, right? We've got the meditators who're stuck in the MRI scans and so on and so forth, and that's kind of fairly well known. Now, what I think is much less known and much less understood or talked about. I don't believe in neuroscience, by the way. I've become a neuroscience atheist. which also will be part of the discussion. But anyway, there are some very interesting implications for the future in emerging technologies where Buddhism is already playing a role and will continue to do so. And I think it's something that we as Buddhists should reflect on. For example, I'm thinking of things like brain-computer interfaces. You bung something on your head, you use your mind in a certain way, and you can control your computer, you can play games and so on. There was a great video on YouTube a few weeks ago now of this woman who was able to, I think she had locked-in syndrome or something, or was quadriplegic or something, and was able to use a robotic arm to lift up a cup of tea and drink it, and it's fantastic. So brain-computer interfaces. Now, if you go to the websites of the people who are selling these gadgets, right, they have apps for their brain-computer things, right? Now, those apps will always include some meditation apps, right? That's kind of interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, very.
So you're using the machine to teach you how to meditate better. Okay, that's fine. Now, what's kind of the next step? Well, you know, obviously we'll be thinking there are many ethical implications of this, where we think of military applications, drones and so on, which is obviously a huge ethical problem. If we're going to be controlling our computers with our mind, with our brain, let's say, let's leave aside the question.
Yeah, let's call it brain.
That brain, then we're obviously going to have to control our brain somehow. Right? So that's where meditation comes in. So in order to be able to control your computer better, then you're going to have to meditate or use some kind of focusing or attention technique to be able to do that. Now then that course then raises, well, do you then go to a Buddhist meditation course so I can learn mindfulness and concentration so that I can pilot my drone more effectively and blow up more people? Well, that's one possible application, right? I mean, this is not theory. I mean, there's already, you know, we had the story of what is it, 3,000 English soldiers going to meditation retreat in Bodh Gaya. So, you know, these things are already happening in one way or another. There are also many other issues. Now, if I'm controlling my computer with my brain, right, then the next step of that, of course, that will be then available on the web. Right? Google will cache it, right? So Google will keep a copy of my brain patterns. Yeah?
Yeah, and the implications, for me, I'm always a little concerned about samadhi that is divorced from panya and sila. I see these as mutually supportive and integrated, and why I'm a little bit hesitant about having classes just in meditation that are so far removed from, but here's how it works in an overall social context. Yes, right. You can just learn meditation, the skill of focus and the skill of awareness. And happily, I do see the building in of panya and sila in things like MBSR. There are components to that, and it may not be to the depth of a full-on Theravada teaching, for example, just as one example. But there are parts to it. But that's one of the things I foresee and seems to be associated with part of what you're talking about, that we do need to, as a society, encourage that inclusion of understanding and of pro-social behaviors and interactions, as well as skills of concentration and awareness.
Absolutely, yeah. So this is why I think that from a Buddhist point of view that we should get involved on the ground floor at a philosophical level and an ethical level. And start talking about these things. I mean, if they are, which they clearly are, is appropriating Buddhist techniques, then, well, you know, we should claim some royalties on that, you know. We should say, you know, well, you hang on, you took our meditation technique, so you owe us a listen.
Yeah.
And we have something to say from a 2,000-year-old tradition that has something to say about, well, look, there's a context in which those things can be used and should be used. You know, let's look at some of the implications of that. So these are some of the issues which I want to look at through this discussion. And this is actually something which, this particular event is one thing, but the topic or the area is actually something I'd like to explore more in the future.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to hearing more about that. We had discussed before the recording, just so folks listening know, that this thing about which we're not giving too many details at this point, we'll have you back on to talk about that at the right time, to fully really engage in this fascinating topic, because it is. So I want to let folks know that there are a few places that you can go online to find out more about this. Of course, there's Sujato's own blog at sujato.wordpress.com. There's also santipada.org and suttacentral.net. All of those will be linked on the episode page for this episode. And we will be having the dear Bhante back with us again in the future, and possibly also to talk about a swift pair of messengers, because that's also a very meaningful and helpful text for us practitioners. Our guest today has been Bhikkhu Sujato. Bhante, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Ted.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to learn more about something you've heard in today's podcast, please go visit the SBA website at secularbuddhism.org, and you'll find an entire webpage devoted to this and every episode. Discussion about this episode can be found on the episode page itself, along with show notes. The music for The Secular Buddhist is used by permission from John Kaizen Neptune CD, Steps in Time. Additional music is provided courtesy of Monty Levinson of Taihei Shakuhachi and Rodrigo Rodriguez. Their websites are also linked on the SBA site on the About Podcast Music page. Until next time, remember, every moment you have a choice. Make it the best you can. See you next time on The Secular Buddhist.